Customers are rushing to your store. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. Shopify POS is your command center for your retail store. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify has everything you need to sell in person. With Shopify, you get a powerhouse selling partner that effortlessly unites your in-person and online sales into the one source of truth. Track every sale across your business in one place and know exactly what's in stock. Connect with customers in line and online. Shopify helps you drive store traffic with plug-and-play tools built for marketing campaigns from TikTok to Instagram and beyond. Get hardware that fits your business. Take payments by smartphone, transform your tablet into a point-of-sale system, or use Shopify's POS Go mobile device for a battle-tested solution. Plus, Shopify's award-winning help is there to support your success every step of the way. Do retail right with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/theathletic, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/theathletic to take your retail business to the next level today. shopify.com/theathletic.
And now, two pigeons bemoaning the fact you can stream DirecTV satellite-free.
Hey, Frank, a little birdie told me you don't need a satellite dish to get DirecTV.
What's little birdie?
Was it Jimmy the Sparrow?
It's a figure of speech. Point is, you can stream DirecTV over the internet now.
Oh, sure. Next you're gonna tell me those big birds are made of metal and filled with people, right?
You mean airplanes?
Stream DirecTV without a satellite dish. Visit DirecTV.com. High-speed internet service required. Terms and restrictions apply.
Welcome to the Leaf Report. This is Clark here. Hello, everybody.
All right, James, no time to waste. It is an off-season podcast. We're now in the off-season, and we have our good friend, Chris Johnson of Sportsnet. Chris, how are you?
Well, guys, what are we talking? Tampa Bay Lightning, Vegas Golden Knights. What's the topic of the day today?
Yeah, can you talk to us about the Islanders' third defense pairing and how you think it's part of their success so far?
No. You need Arthur Staple if you're going to get that one.
Oh, yeah, right. Oh, I thought this was the Islanders. You know what's funny is that I know people. This isn't an original thought, but like you look at the teams that are in the Final Four and there's like all of these... Like, it's almost like the Final Four created to make Leafs fans the most angsty or something. Like, you've got, like, the Lamoriello-led Islanders without Tavares, and you've got Montreal, the rival that knocked you off in the first round, and you've got Vegas, the brand-new team that might win the Stanley Cup. And I don't know about... I mean Tampa's... I mean, I guess because they already won last year, but someone said that Tampa's been in... You know, they're an expansion team that's already won a bunch of Stanley Cups and going for another one here, so... I don't get the sense a lot of Leafs fans are super engaged with the Stanley Cup playoffs right now.
Yeah, and I think that's normal. It's funny. It's a very hockey specific kind of reaction. It seems that when the local teams beat out that somehow as the playoffs go along, you know, in some ways I think the interest does dwindle. Whereas other sports, you know, you culminate with the championship, and even if you're a fan of another team, you're more engaged. I mean, maybe when we get to the Stanley Cup final, people will tune back in, but. I think I can be sympathetic, especially for Leafs fans, because I know it was tough the way that series ended. It was pretty abrupt the last few days. And, you know, I think that there was legitimate reason to believe that they could still be playing now in the Stanley Cup semifinals when the playoffs began. And so to not have your team there, it's just like the air going out of the balloon.
Well, one of the things that's come up in light of one of these teams being in the Final Four, the Islanders, is should the Leafs have kept Lou Lamoriello? And we're not going to talk about that, or we don't really have to. You can if we want.
But Jonas is just going to throw a bomb out there. And then
Yeah. Well, but that leads us into kind of what I was hoping we could do today, and that's do kind of a progress report of management, of Brendan Shanahan, of Kyle Dubas, as we kind of look ahead to the offseason, look back on last season. So I think we should start with Shanahan. James, I'll start with you. We're, 7 years into Brendan Shanahan's tenure as team president. The team has obviously come leaps and bounds from where it was in terms of talent, in terms of like respectability. I think he's brought a lot of like prestige and such back to the organization. But obviously, the playoff drought continues. There's quite a bit of angst in the fan base right now. Where do you think things are at now as we look at Shanahan's tenure so far and kind of where we need to go from here?
Well, I would probably after 7 years, I think this was next step was always going to be the hardest one for the organization. Like, I think it's not easy, but it's not, it's easier to get your team to the place where to go through a rebuild and get to where you're a good team, which I think is fair to say the Leafs are. You know, they're probably, even accounting for what happened in the playoffs, they're probably the 7th or 8th or 9th best team in the NHL, which isn't nothing. I mean, it's certainly better than where they were in the JFJ, Burke, Nonis years. But this next step, going, getting from being a good team to being a great team to being a Tampa or a Vegas or, you know, even Boston, teams that are always in the second, third, and in the finals, they're not there yet. And that's going to be the ultimate, you know, for all the good that the Leafs have accomplished as an organization under Shanahan and become, you know, more respectable. In the end, he's going to be judged on, you know, if the Leafs never get out of the first round, I don't think anyone's going to say that his tenure was a success here.
Yeah, I can't argue with that. I mean, what's interesting is what do we judge him on, right? You know, mm-hmm. Two things that are obvious to me is the front office, because he's responsible for the hockey operations department. And, you know, as much as this hasn't, you know, translated to success yet, I don't have any issue, frankly, with the way the front office is built and the decisions they're making. We can quibble on some stuff, of course. You know, I think that is the case pretty much everywhere. But, you know, I think that this is a very smart, process-driven, in some ways still ahead of the curve front office that's managed their team very well. And certainly this past season built the best team we've seen the Leafs have in quite some time. And so, you know, if we're judging Brendan Shanahan, I can't really criticize him there. And, you know, some of the sort of more business-related things are rebuilding trust among the fan base. I think if you look at the 7 years, they've come leaps and bounds with, you know, some of the things they've done with the alumni, you know, mm-hmm. bringing some pride or whatever you want to call it, restoring something in this organization. Now, what's interesting about this most recent playoff loss, though, is some of that was shaken, right? I mean, you know, it was not a coincidence that he began his season ending remarks, he being Brendan Shanahan, with a pretty lengthy sort of direct lifeline to the fans. I don't know if you wanted to call it an apology, but an olive branch, you know, acknowledging, you know, why people took this particular loss so hard and sort of, you know, understanding, I guess, that success now has to translate to the on-ice results. But, you know, from 10,000 feet, you know, I think this organization has done a whole lot right, from being a bottom feeder 7-6 years ago to where they are today. And you know, now I guess we have to, if they don't get it right, you know, obviously change will come. So, you know, that's kind of the moment that's at hand, I believe, for the organization.
Well, and you both touched on it. I don't think you can take that part for granted. Like, look in Buffalo, look in, like, I don't know if you want to say Vancouver, look in some of these teams that have tried to, I don't know what you, rebuild, I guess, and are just in a even worse situation than they were before. Like, that part, I don't think you can quibble with, really. Like, can you, Chris?
No, and like, this actually came up this year when the Leafs won the North Division in the regular season standings. That was their third division title since 1963. Like, I had to double check and triple check that, because it's just nuts. Seems impossible, given that stretches all the way back to when this was a 16 league. You know, we're on the
I think it's Chris, I think it's only their second one since 63.
No, this was
wasn't
their third.
There only one?
They won one in the 60s, and then they won one in the Pat Quinn era, 99-2000, I think, and then this year. Like, the fact that this fan base is as big as it is, I mean, obviously some of that is just the demographics. Toronto's a big city, probably arguably the city in the world where, you know, produces more hockey players than any individual city in the world, or certainly the GTA does. You know, it's partially where they are, but I mean, it's amazing that this team has that fan base with that track record of success, or in this case, lack of even modest success. And so, you know, I do think it is something that they've gotten to a point where people believe in them again, where I do think their brand is quite strong. You know, I'm fascinated to see, you know, where this Amazon series, you know, what we get to see from the cameras that were behind the scenes with the Leafs this year. You know, I just think that that's smart that they're doing that stuff. Anyone who's even casually following what's happened with Formula One, I mean, that sport has reached a new level because of, you know, the way they've opened up their sport to behind the scenes cameras and the like. And I think it's smart that the Leafs are at the forefront there. And so there's a whole lot to like where they're at from a business and fan perspective, and from, even building the hockey team perspective. And the only piece missing is more on ice success. But I do actually believe that they have the system in place now where that should happen and can happen. But you know, we wait for it to happen.
Since they lost, it's only been like 2 weeks, right? Since it feels like longer than that. I've done a lot of like thinking and looking at the way that organization was built, and correct me, like tell me if you think I'm wrong. You know, sometimes I wonder if the way that the path to how they got here kind of slowed them down or set them up for failure a little bit, where, you know, like you don't have a GM for a while, then you have Lamoriello, then you switch to Dubas, and in like the way that they've done, the scouting department has changed multiple times, who's been in charge of the draft. There's been kind of like a lot of this was made of this in the beginning when there was Hunter and Lamoriello and Dubas and all these different voices were in the front office. Do you think that either slowed them down or maybe hurt their ability to succeed at this point?
I think you could make that case. You know, what it's also done, James, it's not allowed them to manage expectations too well. I mean, even if you go back to that 2016-17 season where, you know, they get into the playoffs in the last weekend of the season and they play Washington with literally nothing to lose. And, you know, if they miss the playoffs that year, we're not talking about five straight playoffs. I know we can sort of parse this any different way, but...
Well, that team wasn't supposed to make the playoffs,
exactly.
Right? Like, we went into that year and no one thought they were going to make the playoffs.
Right, and even...
That was like a dream season.
Yeah, and I just think that... Here's the thing. For anyone that might be out there that thinks that they need to change Kyle Dubas or the front office, I mean, everyone's entitled to their opinion. I'm of the belief, though, you need to give every front office like 5 to 10 years. I know that that's a long time, but it just takes so long for anyone to come in to truly impact all levels of the organization, to go through multiple drafts and develop a player development system in order to bring those kind of prospects along, in order to really see through any vision. You know, no Stanley Cup, even for the teams like Tampa that finally broke through after years and years of knocking on the door last year. I mean, it's easy to say, yeah, they traded for Barkley Goodrow and Blake Coleman, and that was the difference. I mean, I think that made a difference. But, you know, what happened in Tampa was the result of a lot of years of good decision-making, of you know, trying and failing, of learning things. You know, they did have relative stability, even when Steve Yzerman departed as their general manager. I mean, Julian Brisebois was his right-hand man the whole way along. He just stepped seamlessly into that job as the general manager. And I think that, you know, they have benefited from, you know, having John Cooper as a head coach now for 7 or 8 seasons. You know, I think that is the model that should be followed if you can. Now it's hard because it's turbulent, as we're seeing. You know, you lose a playoff series like the Leafs just lost to Montreal that they shouldn't have lost. You know, there's a lot of anger in the market. I think that there's a chill in the front office. I think this is a difficult time right now for the Maple Leafs, and it probably should be, but it's hard to stay the course through those types of things. But, you know, to me, if you're someone who jumps job to job, that person's far less likely to have success than someone who, you know, does long-term business with long-term people. And so, yes, I think the Leafs have definitely failed as an organization over a number of years from never staying the course. You know, that's really what the Shanna plan, as much as we made it into a meme almost, that was it about. If you revisit what Brendan Shanahan said in his closing remarks of that 2015 season, you know, he said that the problem isn't coming up with a plan in Toronto. The problem is sticking to it. I'm paraphrasing, yeah. But that was essentially what he was saying. And, you know, I think right now they're being tested on that, because I think they've come up with a pretty good plan. I think they've clearly improved the organization leaps and bounds, and now they have to find a way to stick with it through, you know, certainly I haven't witnessed this kind of an emotion in the fan base in the city. You know, I did a TV hits out in Maple Leaf Square there a day or two after that series. I mean, someone had defaced the Legends Row statue, had spray painted it a little bit. We saw people burning their jerseys and stuff on social media. I know it's probably a small number of people that get a disproportionate amount of attention, but, you know, there was still a real emotional response to this from Leaf fans. And I think there's a real pressure on the team now that hasn't been there in the past. But I do think they have to stick with it, James. And I think the fact that it's been kind of helter skelter to this point probably hasn't helped them, but it's also going to help them if they do see this through, if they have the same leadership core, if they stick with the same players. I think when they reach a hard moment in the future, they're going to be better prepared to handle it.
Well, I think, like, to your point and James's point, what they've done well is some of the bigger stuff. Like, Shanahan came in and realized we need to get elite talent. Like, and so we need to be bad and we need to win the draft lottery. And obviously you can't control winning the draft lottery, but you put yourself in that position by not making the roster very good. They win the draft lottery. They master those picks. Like, you can say those picks are tap-ins, but like Dylan Strome went before Marner, did he not? Like, you can miss on those things. Like, the Canucks took Oliu-Alevi, I think, in the top five or top six or whatever. Like, not all those things are guaranteed. But to James's point,
they also got Elias Pettersson fifth overall. So
yes, so kudos to them on that. But like, and, well, they, to counter you, then they also took Jake Virtanen, which didn't work. But the point is, like, some of the other stuff, I don't know if it's inexperience. Like, obviously, Shanahan had never been in a front office before he was hired as team president. And to James's point, some of those, like, little, I don't know if you want to call them process things, but like hiring a coach before you had a GM, and then you had a GM who wasn't going to be around the long term, and then you had a coach who wasn't suited to the GM that you had replacing that other GM. So I don't know if those are like inexperienced things. James, like, what do you think? Do you think that's just Shanahan having never done this? Do you think that's just the circumstances where Mike Babcock is out there? He's the best coach available. You go and hire him. Like, how much should he be hit on some of that stuff?
To go back to what Chris said, I think that continuity is important. I think that you do need a lot of time as a general manager or a front office to put your plan in place and to have that play out.
Mm-hmm.
And it's hard. If you're making substantial changes, like changing the GM or changing big pieces of the organization, your timeline almost resets a little bit, right? Like, so if you're going to be patient, but then you make a change in the GM, you have to be almost even more patient with what you're doing if you believe in what's happening there. So they need to get to a place where they can have some continuity, and they're not. The question is, do they believe in the group that they've got right now? And do they believe that they're going to get over the hump with the people in charge that they've got? So is it inexperience? I mean, that was talked about a ton when Shanahan was hired, how he hadn't worked for a team. And certainly there were mistakes made. There were mistakes made. But, you know, if you wait to hire Lou Lamoriello as your GM, he's probably going to pick Mike Babcock as the coach, is he not?
Yeah, true.
Well, and
so maybe
since we're looking back, guys, like, let's remember, they were desperate for credibility, for respectability. You know, you had to sign Mike Babcock to the richest coaching contract in NHL history to get him. And, you know, I actually still don't think that was a mistake doing so. Honestly, I think he turned the organization around and had a huge hand in what happened here in the early days in terms of getting this organization back on track. Mm-hmm. You know, Lou Lamoriello, it would have been probably too soon to hand the team to Kyle Dubas, you know, back in 2015. You know, I know he was interim GM there for a window after Dave Nonis was let go before Lou Lamoriello was brought in, you know, made the Zach Hyman trade among other moves, was kind of front and center actually in the Phil Kessel deal with Pittsburgh at that time in that offseason. But, it, you know, that might've been a little too quickly to hand it to him. You know, I think we have to remember, look, this is not, it's not like putting together an orderly, it's not like building a Lego from ground up where there's clear directions. There's not one way to do it. And everyone's starting from a different place. And the Leafs were a long, long way away 7 years ago. And I, you know, they're much closer today. And I think that they're, honestly, if I still had to place a bet, I don't know what the bet would be. I've still bet they're going to figure it out on, you know, every team's got to go through something, every organization. And I do think that this most recent disappointment is part of their journey.
It's a good point to try and remember back to where they were, because it was such a train wreck. Like, it was such a, like, there was the Horacek situation. There was, you remember Kadri getting suspended and the team didn't salute the fans.
There was the, like, waffles. There was just, remember that stuff? Like, it was bad.
Well, that's before Shanahan, though.
Right. But, like, I'm just saying, like, the aura of the organization, like, to Chris's point, it wasn't there. Like, they didn't have the prestige of, like, what they are or should be, right?
Well, from Shanahan's perspective, that, what was that, his first year or his first 2 years? It was just a complete train wreck. I guess it was probably his first
14, year. 15, and yeah.
The players were, you know, and that's, Shanahan's taking a look at this. He's like, holy cow. Like, he probably at that point was like, my job's bigger than I even thought it was. Like, I got to get rid of some of these players. I got to, you know, and that's where you bring in, I don't know if you want to call them disciplinarians, but like more old school people to try and establish that. That's the Babcock. That's the Lamoriello. Let's like change the culture of the organization. And, you know, they were starting from a very, very low point. I mean, they were basically a laughingstock franchise when he came in.
Yep. But I mean, you could look at some of the, I mean, the Babcock hiring, I agree with Chris. I think it made tons of sense, and he did what he was supposed to do in terms of turning around the team. He obviously didn't get to the point where they wanted or he wanted in terms of a cup, but like you can even go back or circle a little bit forward to the decision to keep him after that one playoff when it was clear or seemed clear in hindsight that he wasn't going to be their guy and they keep him. And then obviously the next season's disjointed. Like you can look at the contracts, you can look at how they handled those situations with Marner, Matthews, Nylander. Maybe that happens regardless of who's in charge, but they didn't get bad results. Like they got all those players signed. Those are key pieces for them, but they're not ideal in terms of like the best possible situation with those contracts. Like, so some of these things, I don't know if it's inexperience, and yet you could say it, who cares? Like they got a lot of this big stuff right that other organizations with more experienced people in charge don't get right. Like it's a hard balance to strike. And then the other hard thing to look at is like their one goal or whatever. You look at that Montreal series, like they beat Montreal. I don't know if that series is played 10 times, they probably beat them 8. Like, and then we're not talking about any of this stuff. Like, Chris, how do you sort through some of those, I don't know, problems or complications, riddles, whatever you want to call it?
Well, certainly the narrative aspect of what just played out against Montreal is fascinating because you're right. They're literally one shot in three games or two games anyway, games 5 and 6 of that series away from no one talking about this. I mean, if they score in overtime in game 5 and it ends 4-1 in round 1, and even no matter what would happen against Winnipeg, I mean, I just think this whole thing is viewed differently. Their moves aren't being scrutinized to the same degree they are now. You know, this is sports though. I mean, this is what every front office has to live with, is that there's either luck involved or just, you know, some small things can go against you and it can have some much larger consequences. I think that's kind of the line everyone walks. You know, that's why I fall on the side of giving them more time, of, you know, even not advocating to blow everything up or trade out of the Cord Four or whatever, you know, else we might get to in this conversation. You know, I don't see a whole lot of reason to relitigate the contracts. You know, I do think what's clear is the Leafs didn't use the full weight of the collective bargaining agreement in their favor in those situations. You know, I think that they could have played it much tougher, for example, with Mitch Marner, you know, who I don't think would have held out to December 1st without a contract, you know, the way that William Elander did. You know, but at that point in time, the bet inside the organization, and it might still be right, is that it just didn't benefit them to have this all play out so publicly, to, you know, be battling their own star players in those sort of contract situations. And so I think that they just wanted to get it done as easily as they could and move on and bet on the talents of those players, which I actually think sets up nicely for viewing what happened in the playoffs now, because that is the fundamental bet the Leafs have made here. They did pay those guys a little bit more probably than they needed to, or than they might have had they handled those negotiations differently, but they did so under the belief fundamentally that those guys are going to pull them through the playoffs and that those guys are going to be the difference between them and most of the teams they would ever come up against head to head in the playoff series. And ultimately, where I fall in the final analysis of their series with Montreal is that we can talk about that series a million different ways. The fact that their top performers underperformed in terms of goals and points per game, didn't produce enough offense, is the reason why they're not still playing now, or why they at least didn't play into the second round. And, you know, that's the responsibility that they bear with the way that the organization treated them, with the way that they're paying them. And, you know, basically what I can see right now, yeah, there's going to be changes this offseason, but when we get to the playoffs next year, it's going to be about does Marner, Matthews, Tavares, and Nylander, and obviously Tavares is sort of exempt from this conversation given what happened to him in the playoffs, but if those players can pull them through or not, that's going to be the difference ultimately, I think, between a long playoff run or more disappointment.
I agree with you, but also it's like the more we cover the sport, the more you realize how different it is and how you need – You can't win with just three or four guys.
The Lightning won with three or four guys last season.
Yeah, but they had good goaltending. Their
Jack Campbell gave the Leafs great goaltending in that series.
No, but what I'm saying is that Tampa didn't win on the back of only like three guys. Like they had offense from only a few players, but they had a lot of other things that they were getting. I mean, you already mentioned Coleman and Gaudreau, who were really, really good in the playoffs. The Leafs need you need something from like 12 or 13 guys to win, probably.
Yeah,
like you. Right, you but can't they didn't get enough
at the top to even have a chance. Like to ultimately,
no.
I mean, obviously they had a chance; they were one shot away. But like, you can't have Marner and Matthews both be stymied to the degree they were and expect to win a series. I think that the responsibility falls mostly on their shoulders. I don't think depth was an issue for them in the series. I really don't.
They had like seven forwards that produced nothing. Like they were rolling the third and fourth line out, and you're like, there's no chance these lines are going to score ever.
Yeah, but that's how like, Tampa no won. Like, that's the way the Leafs are no built. One. I don't see that changing next season, honestly. I think that they're built top heavy and the top guys have to perform or they're not going to play multiple rounds.
Jonas and I have talked about this, but that makes you super susceptible to an injury or something. Like, you know, if Tavares goes down, then all of a sudden, how much better than Montreal is your lineup? And especially when Muzzin goes down as well. I mean, you can be equalized pretty quickly.
Yep. I mean, they weren't better than Montreal when that happened, right? I mean, they didn't have Montreal could force, you know, focus all its defensive attention on the top line and keep those guys, you know, largely in check. And the Montreal probably had better offensive depth through their lineup, you know, below that top line.
Well, and what I would argue, and Chris and I have disagreed about the depth thing, but I would point to their drafting, and you can go back since Shanahan took over and like how long does a guy need to judge him on it? I think it's been long enough. He's been around since 2014. They just haven't produced enough. Like they've hit, credit to them, they've hit with those first round picks, but they haven't really found a lot of players otherwise. And like that's like you talk about Tampa. Like Anthony Cirelli, Eric Chernak, one of those guys that didn't draft. They didn't draft Chernak, but like those guys were making entry level money last year. You look back to some of the Pittsburgh teams, they were fueled by a lot of like entry level players that they drafted, and the Leafs haven't had that. And like that necessitates you going into free agency without a lot of money and rolling the dice on guys like Wayne Simmonds and Joe Thornton. Like that's something I think if you look at Shanahan's tenure. And James mentioned like the Mark Hunter stuff and who was in charge. The drafting hasn't been good enough to this point, and I think that hurt them and has hurt them, and we'll see how it plays out in the next couple of years. Like, do you think that's fair, CJ?
I do think it's fair. You know, when you look at Tampa, though, they get what? Stamkos and Hedman at the top of the draft in 08 and 09.
Yeah.
You know, they're adding the players you're referencing, you know, 6, 7, 8 years later. I mean, I think the drafting is going to come into even more focus the longer they stick with this core because it is going to become more of a factor. You know, and what's interesting now, of course, is they expended a ton of draft capital at this trade deadline. And I know they've done so in you know, previous deals as well. I mean, they haven't had as many picks and, you know, I know they can sign some of these players as free agents this upcoming summer, but you know, it's hard to see the drafting bailing them out at this stage. You know, I think that will be the case 3 or 4 years down the line that they're going to need to have some of those guys come along. You're hoping a Rodion Amarov and maybe some other players taken in these last few drafts, you know, might be able to make a difference, you know, when you get to that stage. But, you know, I still see their path to next season probably being similar to the way it was last year, where they're just looking for creative ways to fill out a roster. You know, they might sign fewer older guys as they did last offseason. I think you might see some adjustment there. You know, make a trade or two, but you know, largely, I think they're going to basically use the same strategy they used last season in trying to build around the main core of the team and take another run at it next year with kind of the same approach.
All right, I've brought up Tampa. We can extend this debate just slightly. I don't want to like the Lightning that won last year in the playoffs. Like they had guys like Killorn and Cirelli and Coleman and Gord that were deeper in their lineup that produced, you know, even someone like Killorn who gets 5 goals in that run or Coleman, you know, they had a large group of players that had 9 or 10 plus points over the course of the playoffs. If you look at who the Leafs have,
6 points from Kerfoot, didn't they, in round one?
Yeah, well, that's one guy, and I named like 3 or 4 from the Lightning. The problem to me, like not the main problem, but one of the problems is the Leafs were putting out Thornton, Simmonds, Engvall, Mikheyev, Foligno, they were putting out guys like Brooks and Nash. They had so many forwards that were never a threat to score ever. Like, I think they need just a little bit more. They need something but down in those third
James,
and fourth
like,
lines.
If Matthews and Marner do it, they're
yeah, I know.
Them. But I agree with you.
Your margin for error is so small, though. If like
yes,
if you literally get nothing, like I think they got to get. They need to whoever they fill out with those depth free agents. Like, you know, some people have been saying if they would have signed Corey Perry instead of Thornton or something, like they just need a little bit more from those depth guys that aren't making a lot of money.
Yeah, and that's probably why I wouldn't be surprised to see them go a little bit younger to look for some value buys there, you know, rather than just the graybeards. You know, I can't say in theory I didn't hate the idea of what they did last offseason. And as I say, I do think they built the best team they've had. But, you know, they might have went a little too far in one direction. And so that's the recalibration that happens now. I suppose you're also hoping for, you know, a graduate or two from the Marlies, whether that's someone like Joey Anderson to play in the bottom six, or, you know, maybe Nick Robertson's ready next year. He had such a kind of a strange season this year. It's hard to say, you know, where he'll be at when training camp comes around in September. But look, it would be great to find players that can contribute down the lineup. It's just, you know, they can't really pay anyone more than $1.5 million to fill those positions. And so that's the challenge, as long as they're going to stick with the big four. I mean, I think that to me is the debate when you're talking about, do you trade one of their top players to redistribute through the lineup? I mean, that's what it boils down to. How good of a or dangerous of a bottom six can you build with the current parameters? And if you were to trade, you know, one of their difference makers who soaks up more of the cap room, what more can you do, you know, through the lineup if you make that decision?
Well, that's a perfect segue for the final thing I want to ask you guys about Shanahan, and then we'll take a break and move on to Kyle Dubas. But I'll start with you, James. What do you make of this bet that they are making, which CJ mentioned, where Shanahan is basically saying, they said it on the day that they wrapped up the season, we're bringing those guys back. We're not changing our fundamental belief in the way we built this team. What do you make of that bet? James, you can go, and then CJ, you can follow up.
I can't sit here and say for sure that it's wrong. I'm just surprised that they came out so forcefully 2 days after the season ended and said that's what they were doing. I thought maybe there would be a little bit more evaluation, or maybe you look at what the market's like or what you want to do. Honestly, though, I think Chris is right, though, that they did overpay. But if you talk about, like, to what extent did they overpay? How many millions against the cap has it really hurt them? I think combined all of the contracts, like, I don't think Nylander's not an overpay at all. I mean,
it's like a few million.
We always knew Matthews was going to get 11 million. So like if he's over, it's like hardly anything. He's going to be the runner up for the Hart Trophy.
Yep.
You know, so between Marner and Tavares, how far are they over? And the answer is that it's a lot less than paying Zaitsev $4.5 million or giving Patrick Marleau $6+ million, or like, it's the combined effect of giving those four guys the money they did is less. It hurts you less than some of the other decisions that this organization has made the last 4 or 5 years.
CJ?
I agree.
Well, and here, I'll add one point to that. They were anticipating a rising cap. They couldn't have anticipated any of this. But to James's point, what they could have done is said, you know what? The situation has changed. The landscape has changed. Our team has not gotten over the hump. Let's take a few weeks and let's evaluate this. We need to think about this. Like, maybe instead of coming out so forcefully and saying we believe in those guys, they're going to deliver, they could say, you know what? Like, this is a disappointing season, disappointing result. We're going to take some time and evaluate it and evaluate whether we need to make a change and just leave it at that.
Yeah. You know, and I guess they could still make that change. Even though they said what they said, I don't believe that's what they're going to do, though. I take them at face value on this. I think it really, remember we were talking about stability in the front office. I think what it comes down to is they just believe in this plan that if they roll back this core group time and time again, if they, you know, make adjustments around the margins and, you know, try to bring in different players that can be of support to those guys, that, you know, at some point in time, it's going to work. You know, it's funny. I'm covering the Islanders Lightning series now. And one thing John Cooper said that I thought was interesting is he mentioned that, you know, for Tampa, they had to sort of learn about they had to learn how to win through the sort of pain of losing, which is, you know, a common refrain we've heard coaches talk about, including Mike Babcock. But he said, you know, organizationally, we had to learn the type of guys we needed too. And you know, he was talking about the support pieces and he didn't elaborate on what exactly he meant. But I do think that that is part of what this is. You know, last offseason, obviously, they felt that there wasn't enough experienced guys, you know, to help support the younger players. They signed tons of experience. Now they can probably look at that a little differently. I think, you know, I think that that's partly what goes on here. But fundamentally, the bet is the same, that so few teams can ever amass this much high-end talent, and that if you give that talent enough opportunities, that they're going to knock down the door. And I think that will, whether or not they do it, will ultimately be how we judge Brendan Shanahan, how we judge Kyle Dubas in terms of their tenures in Toronto. You know, and I do think it's a reasonable bet to make, even though we're coming off a season or a playoffs where it didn't pay off for them. But I think that's why they came out and said it so quickly, is that they're not wavering in their belief that this is the way to success, even if it didn't bring success as quickly as they'd like.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 U.S.-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 U.S.-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service anytime. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
And now, two pigeons bemoaning the fact you can stream DirecTV satellite-free.
You see this? A family watching baseball on DirecTV with no satellite dish in sight.
Let's heckle them.
You call that changing the channel?
Choke up on the remote, buddy.
I hope getting all these games on DirecTV makes up for your mother not pre-chewing your sunflower seeds.
DirecTV has the most MLB games. Visit DirecTV.com. Claim based on total games offered on national and regional sports networks with choice package or higher. Availability of RSNs varies by zip code and package. High-speed internet service required. Terms and restrictions apply.
To follow up on the discussion we were having about Brendan Shanahan, I think Kyle Dubas, obviously, you know, he signed all those guys. Like, he's been here since all of them but Nylander were here. So he's been involved in everything. One of the things I think is interesting about Kyle Dubas, he's obviously taking heat now. But I think one of the things that is notable about his time as GM is he has shown a willingness to adapt and evolve, and like, he's mentioned it a few times that people have this idea of him as just one thing. Like, he's just about stats. And I think he's shown that he's been willing to evolve. I guess last season felt like maybe over evolution, James, like in terms of some of the moves he makes. Where do you think he kind of steers it from here?
Devolution?
Devolution. Sure.
Yeah, it's I mean, it's easy to look at. It just, the overcorrection that happened there just seems so extreme. Like, it'll be interesting to see what they do this offseason in terms of what we're talking about, the pieces that they are going to be able to bring in. And we should talk about probably at some point, like, how much room there is even for them to change the roster. I mean, obviously there's a ton of UFAs. There's not a ton of cap space. They can change the complexion of you know, the bottom half of the roster for sure. You know, I would say, you know, it's interesting, you know, Jonas, if we, and Chris, if we went through and we graded the job that Kyle Dubas was doing, like, let's say we did it every month, you know, going all through the last 2 years.
New feature at The Athletic.
Yeah.
Another report monthly, card.
Yes.
The monthly do. I mean, it would probably do well. It would probably have 500 comments the next day, no matter what it said. But, like, you know, I think that, like, coming out of the offseason that they had last year, I think that the grades would have been pretty good. And I actually, you know, after the trade deadline, I did grades for the trade deadline, and I think I had it as a B or a B minus. Like, I wasn't there cutting down their trade deadline because I was like, you know what? Like, everything's going so well. There's an argument to not, like, completely dramatically change your lineup, given you don't want to, like, necessarily pull anyone out of a position where they're succeeding right now. So, you know, but in hindsight, the trade deadline looks terrible. So, we have the benefit of using hindsight to evaluate Kyle Dubas, but, you know, I think that, you know, his moves going into the year and then during the year, I think that largely it would have been endorsed by most people. And when it goes sideways at the end, then you can nitpick it and point to things like Joe Thornton and, you know, those kinds of things that didn't work. But I think for the most part, I mean, let's put it this way, to sum everything up, he had a much better last 12 months than he did the previous 12 months.
And I think the next 2 months will be interesting because, you know, to me, I still think there's some foundational change coming to this organization. You know, not on the level of the core four, but, you know, I've written and talked with us elsewhere, but, I really believe it's highly unlikely we'll see Zach Hyman back with the Leafs. I believe he's at a spot where the market is willing to pay him an amount that doesn't make sense for the organization, and it's too much for him likely to pass up, as much as, you know, I know he's loved playing in his hometown and all that type of things. I mean, you kind of heard that in his voice actually a little bit when he spoke directly after the season. But I think that there's an understanding that while things could change, I guess the Leafs could make another move. You know, I'm just not sure that his, what he needs and what they need is lined up right now. So, you know, that's a big potential change. You know, I don't know that they're going to trade Morgan Rielly, but I don't think we can rule it out entirely. I don't think they're heading into that offseason by any stretch with that as a priority, but it, you know, there's a decision pending there with Morgan entering the final year of his contract. You know, and they have a goaltending position to fill. And, you know, as much as Frederik Andersen, it's been clear for some time that you know, his time is likely up in Toronto, you know, just with the way the last 2 years played out for him here. You know, we should remember from the outside that he's a huge part of their leadership group. He's very close with their young players. He spent 5 seasons here. He won a lot of games. He played a lot of big games for them. And so, you know, I think there'll be a change there. And when you, even if only one of those things happen, but probably two of them, you know, I think most likely we see a different goaltender than Andersen here. And, you know, I do think Hyman's going to move on in free agency. You know, that's still a sizable change for this group. And it does open up some other possibilities with the cap space. It's not a huge amount of cap space where, you know, I don't expect that there'll be massive players for the, you know, the top guys getting the biggest contracts, you know, come July 28th. But, you know, there is some flexibility there to play with. And I do think it's going to be yet another sort of new look team beyond the absolute top guys, you know, come training camp.
Well, and we've heard pretty consistently from Kyle Dubas that he believes that all this is just kind of like a prelude to them getting over the top. All these frustrations, all the heartache, that eventually it's going to pay off. And part of that is what you're talking about, Chris. It's, he's saying, we believe in those guys at the very core of the roster. Like, I think I, at one point in a story, like, broke it down into like different tiers of the core. And those guys are like the very core. Like, they're the, I don't know, James, you could tell me, like, the earth, the levels of the earth, they're at the very top or bottom.
My 6-year-old could probably tell you better than me.
Right. All right. But so one of the questions I've been wondering about, and James, you can start, and CJ, you can follow, is, has he been maybe too faithful in those guys? And maybe like too, I mean, you go back to the contracts, you can go back to anything, you can go back to sticking through it with them or sticking with them through this. Do you think he's been overly reliant or faithful or whatever the word is in those core four players and not willing to say, you know what, I like those guys, but like I need maybe a little bit more Steve Yzerman, cold-blooded, whatever?
I think that's a good question. I'm going to even flip it around to another direction here a little bit. But like, Chris, do you think his faith is shaken in that belief in these guys at all based on what's happened?
I don't. I think that he's more resolute in his belief that those guys are going to make difference than ever before. I mean, if we take away 7 games in 12 days against Montreal in May, you know, this was probably Auston Matthews' most dominant season.
Yeah,
I don't know if it was Mitch Marner's best season, but it's in the conversation. You know, he's had some pretty spectacular point producing years in the past. You know, William Nylander had a great playoffs, again, very short, but, you know, I think he stepped up in a way that he hasn't in those times. You saw it in the production, but also just, I think, his engagement in the games. And Tavares had a really strong second half after a slow start and improved his defensive metrics. And, you know, unfortunately just didn't get to play in the series because of his injury. And so I think that they see a year where those guys took steps, even if it didn't yield the result right in the moment that you needed it. So I don't think I really don't believe that he's been shaken by that. And honestly, what this probably comes down to is like, do you view hockey as a strong link or weak link game, right? Is it the team with the strongest player that wins, or the team that doesn't have the weakest player that wins? You know, are you looking for absolute depth, or can you win with a star system? And, you know, pretty clearly Kyle Dubas and Maple Leafs management believes that the team with the most stars, you know, should win. Yeah, I think that there's a debate to be had, though. Look at the way the Islanders are built, for example, even the way Montreal's had success in this playoffs. I know there's some other factors at play there, but those are teams that are kind of more, they don't have the high end elite skill in their lineup, but they're really strong sort of from top to bottom. You know, I think the Leafs believe in this vision still, and that's why there'll be changes, but there won't be changes to those particular players.
You know what's so interesting is that so much of the criticism of going with the core four and giving them the money and everything was that you're not going to have enough money left over to have a strong D-core or be good in goal. And I think both of those myths were kind of torpedoed this year because they had the best blue line that they've had in, you know, whatever, 17, 18 years. They got good goaltending for not a lot of money. I think it's false that you can't do that. Like, I think you can build. I mean, Vegas has proven that. I mean, before getting Pietrangelo, you can have a pretty good D-core for not a lot of money if you're really smart about it. And, you know, Brody, I would say, outplayed his contract. Morgan Riley is worth more than his deal. Justin Hall makes only $2 million. Bogosian had a good year, et cetera. Jake Muzzin had a really good year. You can build a good blue line for, I got to do the math in my head here, 15, you know, 17, 18 million in your top four, and then a couple guys not making a lot of money on your bottom six. So, you know, you can have a good D-core for $19, $20 million. You know, that's possible. You can find a good goaltender for $1.5 million, $2 million, $3 million.
Yeah, but
dollars
hang on, James.
If you're smart.
A good enough goaltender for what? Like, they, to win a cup?
Yeah, but
cup?
He wasn't the problem, Jonas. He wasn't the problem, Jonas.
I mean, like who was the better goalie in the series? Carey Price.
But there's, I mean, I can give you lots of instances of teams that have won the cup without a goalie that made a whole bunch of money.
Yeah, but to this point, it hasn't worked. Like, I mean, you can't really say.
Well, it's worked around the league over and over again. I'm not saying that, like, the Leafs also haven't tried a whole bunch of underpriced goalies. I mean, like, they've put money into goaltending, but like some of that stuff about spending all this money on the four forwards means you can't build the rest of the roster. I'm not sure if that's true or not.
Well, I mean, you were just talking about it with their forwards that it makes it.
Yeah, but they made the wrong bets though, is what I'm saying. Like they brought in the wrong players,
but
like that $1.5 million.
The counter is you don't have any money to spend. Like there's not that many guys who will take $1.5 million to $700,000 who are that good. Like it's,
you don't have a middle class basically at that position. Like it's
exactly,
just not possible.
Right?
You know, they got to sign some guys that make $1.5 million or $2 million that outperform their contracts. Like they need some Justin Halls up front that can produce offense and that can complement their best players. Like Galchenyuk's a good example of a guy not making a lot of money. You play him with good players, he becomes more than the sum of what he is. And mm-hmm. they need a lot more than that. So, you know, they probably need, you know, it's going to be hard to replace Zach Hyman, but they need to somehow find a way to take that $5 million or whatever he would get and break it up and spread it throughout the forward group and use it in a different way and get something out of that. You know, yeah, it's hard, but that's the bet that they're making though.
Right. You know, what's interesting, you look at other teams and obviously Tampa benefits with the tax situation, but they do have a middle class of forwards, right? They have Palat and Gord and Cirelli and Killorn. You know, all those guys make what I would call middle class money between $4 to $5.5 million. The Leafs, if we look at the departures from the organization, you know, all the way back, you know, Bozak, JVR, Kadri, trading Andreas Janssen and Kasperi Kapanen, you know, potential departure of Zach Hyman. I mean, the trend there is they can't have guys making somewhere around $4 to $5 million. And I know JVR got more in free agency, but in general, I mean, that they basically had to deplete their middle class again and again and again. You know, I don't know how you make up for that. You know, there's only so many guys born in Toronto that are willing to give you the Jason Spezza discount. I mean, where would they be without him? Honestly, like that's one that's paid off so well, just how productive he's been, how willing he's been for them to move him around the lineup, to scratch him occasionally, to run him through waivers once this year, which you know, gave them a cap benefit. You know, they have to find more of that, but it's, you know, it's not that plentiful out there, I don't believe. I don't think there's that many options that truly fit that bill.
Well, 2 points I want to make, and either of you can follow up. One, on CJ's point about those, the top players, One thing that I do think merits like some scrutiny is what's happened to some of those guys in the postseason. I don't know if like you can just say it's small sample size. Is it random? Like, why has Mitch Marner not looked like Mitch Marner in the last, I don't know, most of the last three playoffs? Like that merits some scrutiny. And then the other question, and maybe James, you want to take it from here. I wonder if like Kyle Dubas has maybe shifted, like you talk about overcorrection, like maybe lost what he was. Like he built his teams on speed and skill, and increasingly that team was not as skilled, I think, as it was portrayed, nor as fast. Like, do you think maybe he's kind of got to get back to who, I don't know, it seemed like he was? I don't even know if that's fair.
I think some of that ties in with what we're talking about and how hard it is to find players that fit that mold that are going to be making hardly any money and that are going to be productive. Like, it's how many like fast, younger, skilled, when you're in the bargain bin, you don't have the choice of everything you want. So I do think they're going to have to try and find some of those elements. I don't know if they're going to be able to or not. I mean, that's the probably the tail of next season is going to be like, what do we think the biggest X factors are? Like in the playoffs, are the big guys going to step up and perform? And like, are the changes they make going to give them more?
There's stuff for Sheldon Keefe. He would admit right. That needs to be cleaned up, starting with the power play.
Right. And there's supposed to be a Sheldon Keefe section of this podcast too, correct?
Yeah, we're not going to have time for it. That'll be a separate podcast, I guess.
Love the off-season content, guys.
Yeah, well, it's not like we're short of time. I mean, there's not going to be a meaningful Leafs game played for 4 months. So I'm sure we'll reconvene this roundtable at some point. But
the power play is a huge part of what we're talking about here, though. Like, I know it doesn't make for a sort of sexy podcast topic, but you know, you look at Tampa, they had 16 power play goals in their first 12 games this playoffs. Now, that's ridiculous and probably unsustainable and probably not necessarily the bar, but if you have the Leafs talent, I feel like those players need to be cashing in on the power play because A, it just keeps some of the heat off them for their point production. I think it allows them to feel good. And it's clearly an area where the Leafs fell on their face this season. And if they get one more power play goal in that series with Montreal, again, they're probably in round two and onwards. And so that can't be repeated with this group of players, you know, just being that ineffective. You know, it's pretty much inexcusable that they weren't able to correct that. And to me, again, I feel like fans probably only have so much interest in hearing about that or focusing on that, but that plays a huge role in how we're viewing their top guys, because that's where so many top players, you know, get their point production from.
Do you look at that, Chris, that failure is like, is that Manny Malhotra? Is that Sheldon Keefe? Is that like when it was happening during the season, it's like, okay, like we've seen this before. Teams go into droughts on the power play. They're going to come out of it. They're going to figure it out. Like normally it's cyclical, but theirs was not cyclical. I don't know if I can think of another skilled team that basically they went like 35 or 40 games where the power play was garbage. Obviously, they have to fix that. What's the answer to fixing that, do you think?
Well, it might be as simple as changing the assistant coach in charge of it. You know, I think Manny Malhotra, it's tough in this market, right? Like, we don't get to talk to the assistants. I don't feel like I have a tremendous amount of insight into how it all works behind the scenes. We know that he was the assistant coach tasked with it. But, you know, obviously, it was such a big concern that Sheldon Keefe bears responsibility in that, too. You know, it's not like one guy has to fix it. I think that you have a coaching staff for a reason to bat ideas around and to try different personnel and try different schematic things and all that type of stuff. And they couldn't come up with a solution. You know, if you go back and watch actually in game 7, when they had a power play in the third period, you know, Sheldon Keefe that had the whiteboard out and his top players around him at the bench, you know, diagramming plays. So, you know, at least in that moment when it was the most important power play arguably of the season, you know, he was there, you know, instructing the players on what he wanted to see. And so, you know, I can't pretend to know as much about the most skilled observers of this game about what it was that was missing. You know, I think that they did try a lot. They didn't try all the things that I guess were obvious. You know, certainly getting back to Nylander and Matthews on opposite flanks, other than that one power play in game 7 where they went to that. You know, but that worked for them years ago when those players were young. But they do have to find an answer. And I think ultimately it falls at Sheldon Keefe's feet. You know, he gives that responsibility to someone else, but he has responsibility for all the coaching staff. And so, you know, whether it's changing who's making those decisions in terms of behind the bench, or they have to blow it up and start fresh, you know, one way or another with this much skill, you know, they have to find a way to have that be a difference maker for them, because, you know, I think that that's how they're built. They're built to make you pay when you know, cross the line against them in a playoff series, and they didn't make Montreal pay enough, even though, you know, they did get a couple power play goals in that series, but mm-hmm. there's some pretty big moments where they didn't get one, and that was the difference.
All right, let's wrap up on this. I'm wondering if you are, James, maybe you can play the part of Kyle Dubas. You're talking to the board, and you're trying to convince them that, like, this is still, you've still got this ship moving in the right direction despite all the angst in the city. What's your case? What do you say?
I'm trying to convince the board?
Yeah, you're Kyle.
I think what you do is you say, this is a game of inches, and we should have won that series. We lose our captain, our $11 million center. We lose Jake Muzzin. We outplay Montreal for a large percentage of the series. And like you said earlier in the podcast, if we play that series again, we're going to win it. And you point to, look how well we played during the whole year. Look at the progress the team has made in my time here as GM. The roster is better. You ask anybody. We're moving in the right direction. And then you lay out the plan for the coming season, why you're going to be even better than you were last year. I think that's the case.
Right. You know, and
the case is...
Sorry to interrupt, yep, James. I think you also yep. point to history here, which is something Kyle's done a little bit, but you point to all the teams that have fallen on their face repeatedly and broke through by staying the course. I think that that's a key part of the messaging that has to happen. I think that's something they've already shared with the players. You know,
but I don't, the thing with that though, Chris, is that just because a team's fallen on its face a bunch of times doesn't mean they're going to break through.
No, but just because a team's fallen on its face a bunch of times doesn't mean it will continually do so forever either.
Like, it doesn't necessarily mean that they're the. I get what you're saying. Like,
the cause and effect is that if those teams changed, you know, if the Red Wings traded away Steve Yzerman before 1997, maybe they never win a cup. Like, if you abandon the plan that you've built, then, you know, you risk just going in circles, which is what the Leafs used to do, right? They'd have modest success and then chase, you know, like that. I mean, this is going way back for the older fans of the podcast, but like they get to game 7, 2013 with a team that really has no business being there. And then they have one of the most insane off seasons you've ever seen yeah. right after it. And that set the course for the next 3 or 4 seasons though, like buying out Grabowski and all that stuff, signing the Clarkson contract. I mean, I think what you're trying to hammer home, no matter how you maybe you frame it, is that, you know, the best way off course is to overreact to what happened in one series or even a handful of series the last couple of years. Like, I think that you have to look at the bigger picture, and you have to look how many times teams have had to kind of go through a lot of shit to lift that Stanley Cup. And you're right. There's no guarantees. It's not a direct predictor. But, you know, if the way I look at it, frankly, almost every player that has ever had a career that's going to be as good as Auston Matthews has found a way to win a Stanley Cup. I actually think it's that simple. There's almost no generational player in this sport's history that hasn't found a way to win that thing. And so we have, this is the argument to the board, we have what teams could lose for 10 years and not get. And so we would be mistaken to overreact to, yeah. to 12 days and, you know, some mitigating circumstances and vastly change course here.
That's not but the question for the board is this the right group of management to get the most out of the roster? And, you know, like, changing course would be, is this plan, do we believe in this plan and these people in charge?
They would be insane to change management right now.
I mean, no, I don't think anyone thinks they're going to, but, you know, if it continues to not succeed, you know, at some point something changes.
Right. I mean, that's the thing. You can preach process, but at some point you have to win, or else the message won't continue to resonate.
All right, boys, let's leave it there. We're gonna have to reconvene now to do Sheldon Keefe, just do a progress report maybe at some point in the offseason. We got lots of time. So
I didn't think he took as much heat in the aftermath of that loss as was probably merited. Like, I think that
yeah.
you know, and obviously we're three of the people that would give out such heat. So maybe that's on us a little bit too individually. But, you know, I think that the second guessing of the players and stuff was fair. But, you know, I felt like the coaching staff maybe didn't find quite enough solutions in that series. And it's 2 years in a row that they kind of, I wouldn't say Columbus was a vastly inferior opponent and even Montreal, but that they haven't broken through against a team that they have more skill than.
Yep. 100%. So that's a perfect preview of the next Chris Johnson appearance on the Leaf Report. So CJ, thank you for coming on. Everyone check out his work at Sportsnet, and James and I will be back very soon. James, do you want to bid us adieu? Adieu? Is that how you say it?
Very good. Very good, Jonas. Thanks. Even working on your French. thanks for coming on, Chris. Always a good time.
You guys didn't even ask me this mystery player the Leafs are going to acquire
why don't you just reveal it here at the end and then everyone will be listening.
I teased on the Dangle podcast. Well, we'll keep everyone listening.
People are guessing it's Jonathan Toews. Do you want to shoot that one down?
I don't. It's not Jonathan Toews. That's not who I was referencing anyway. What I love is how many people went through every roster of every American team that didn't make the playoffs and was guessing at who it might be. I mean, bless you, Leaf fans. I'd love to tell you more. I don't want to set off too big of a fire alarm, but I'm still resolute that there's one guy that I think they're trading for this offseason.
I've heard some names.
Oh, baby.
Well, it'll be. We'll see.
All right, boys. Thank you.
As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10, place your first bet on any game, and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY 467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.